giant robots smashing into other giant robots.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. I'm Ben, and I'm here today with the inimitable Derek Reimer. Hey, Derek.
Hey, Ben.
So, we're back home from MicroConf.
Yeah.
MicroConf was the thing that happened.
How was your experience?
It was awesome.
Yeah.
It was, going to two was kind of a lot. I think it was five, ended up being 5 days in Vegas. Is a lot of Vegas.
To be in Vegas. Yeah.
but not, it wasn't too bad. The conference itself was very solid, mm-hmm. and I'm really happy with how my talk went.
Awesome. Last year was your first MicroConf, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
So how did you like the split of growth and starter this year compared to the combined one last year?
I think I was okay with it. I liked it as a speaker, as I said earlier, because
yeah,
it let me tailor my talk a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I would have gotten an invite to speak at growth.
Yeah.
So it was nice to have that opportunity. I didn't mind it too much. It was kind of a bummer that part of the way through, a bunch of people that I knew left.
Yeah.
And I ended up not getting a chance to see a lot of those people very much because I was still finishing my talk.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to not be in that position, but I was. And so I, like, a couple of the cocktail hour things, I skipped, like, one of those and then missed some of the talks and just didn't have quite as much exposure to the people that I'm friends with already.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of sad for
yeah.
me.
No, I can hear you. Yeah, there were a number of folks who I'm accustomed to seeing every year for the last 4 or 5 years, and I just got to see them briefly in passing at the little handoff party.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'd say that's sort of the drawback. I think my hunch is that at net, it's a good change.
Yeah.
But not being able to see people, kind of one of the drawbacks. Multitrack is an interesting idea. I was chatting with Rob about formats after the mm-hmm. after starter, and he was like, don't say multitrack. I was like, well, maybe there's a way to do multitrack that doesn't suck, and then everyone's at least there at the same time, and
yeah,
yeah, unclear.
Yeah.
But overall, really good experience. I feel like I always walk out with like a lot of inspiration and interesting ideas. I feel like I learned some really interesting things. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, as a educational experience, solid again.
Yeah.
And as like a talking to other people doing what I'm doing thing, also very good.
Yeah. Same here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, so the big thing for me was like I was basically like 90% focused on my talk for the mm-hmm. thing, which is one of the drawbacks of speaking, where it's like it's kind of the only thing I'm thinking about, and like I said, I was spending a lot of time not at other things because of it.
Yeah.
But I am happy to say that I think it turned out really well.
I heard you killed it.
Oh, thank you.
In a good way.
I'm glad that's the word. It was one of those things where it wasn't feeling so I gave the talk Wednesday morning and it didn't feel right as of like what Monday night. I was still like, this talk just it's just not quite there. And then I woke up at 2:30 in the morning, Tuesday morning.
Oof.
And like was just like, I figured it out. And I went over to my computer and I wrote down like a bunch of stuff. And I was like, yeah, there we go. This will be fine now.
Nice.
And then I went
nice.
Back to bed. It was like this weird, my like subconscious just like figured it out while I was sleeping.
Wow.
And then after that it was like, okay, now I feel like I'm just polishing. This is like roughly where it needs to be.
Were you like under stress during that whole time, or were you expecting that moment to come where it would all click in for you?
I was kind of under stress, actually. I wasn't really sure how it was going to turn out. I was in this kind of mindset where it's like, okay, the talk as it stands is not going to bomb, but I think it's just going to be like a B-ish mm-hmm. kind of talk, and mm-hmm. that wouldn't satisfy me. So I wasn't like, you know, terrified that everyone was going to think that I was a horrible speaker.
Yeah.
But it was just, it was stressful.
Yeah.
Like I've mentioned, I want to do a really great job on talks all the time, so
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It wasn't where I wanted it to be.
Yeah,
but it was a surreal experience, like to just like wake up. It was like I like woke up and was like, "That's it." It was bizarre. It was like one of those like flash of inspiration moments.
Yeah, those are rare. Those are rare.
Yeah, that has never happened to me actually with a talk. It's usually more like it kind of just iteratively slowly appears, and eventually it's mm-hmm. like I chisel enough of the marble away that there's the talk.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But this time it was kind of just like all at once.
It usually only occurs with me with like programming things or like figuring out something technical. I've had like something come to me. In the
yeah,
middle of that
totally.
Before, you know?
Yeah. But so like I wrote, I think like two versions of the talk and threw those away after I did the survey and then gave a third version to Damagi and then felt like that was terrible and then threw most of that away and then it kind of went through like two more major iterations.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever had a talk that has changed quite so much from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was kind of a side effect of that, like the talk wasn't a thing that I had thought of and then proposed to give. It was kind of like I was trying to distill the talk out of things I knew and things I thought about and things I cared about.
Right.
But it went well. I had attention, which is like, that's like one of my biggest things I pay attention to. It's like, how much eye contact am I getting?
Right.
And I did a handful of like weird things like I always do, like some snapping, clapping exercises and some like, let's talk, like let's chant in rhythm and like all kinds of like just weird things.
Yeah.
And a couple times I could feel people drifting a little bit. And so I hopped off the stage, which really freaks people out because they're like, oh, God, what if he comes and calls on me?
Nice.
So I think I had just enough of that I was holding people pretty well. And then I was happy at the end of the day with where the content ended up of the talk.
Were you in growth when Ezra gave his talk?
I was not,
on e-commerce
unfortunately.
Stuff? Okay. His talk was funny because I think he's accustomed to quite a bit of audience interaction. And I got the sense like within the first 10 minutes of his talk, he was really like, come on, guys, are you even interested in this stuff? Because I think it's the MicroConf audience is historically mellow group. You know, we're just kind of pretty chill and probably a bit less animated than some of the venues that he's spoken at.
So I gave this feedback to Rob is that I think there were some aspects of that room that kind of reinforced that lack of interaction. Just the way like there's a stage that was kind of set back from the audience. The audience was in darkness.
Yeah.
It just has like, it felt like there was a pretty intense separation of speaker and audience. And so we were kicking around some ideas of like, if there's like a way to put the stage kind of in the middle, like in a, like a amphitheater style where it's like the audience kind of wraps around the stage and like you can see everybody cause they're at like a different elevations. I think there was some elements cause I heard a number of speakers comment on that. The fact that they felt like the audience was like a little bit unresponsive, a little bit dead kind of.
Yeah.
I think the room and the setup and the ambiance actually plays into that quite a bit. It may just be that actually is the MicroConf audience and they're not there to interact with you as a speaker. They're like, no, I'm here to learn. No talking.
But, yeah. And my first experience on stage was quite a thrill.
Let's hear about it. I was there, but share the experience from your perspective, if you would.
Yeah. So just to quickly recap, I gave an attendee talk, a 12-minute talk that was voted on by the attendees. So you could throw your hat in the ring to give one of these shorter talks, and the top 8 were chosen. And so my talk was on transforming customer input into features, something that I feel like I know pretty well from my day-to-day. So I was pretty comfortable with the subject matter. And so the biggest hurdle for me was the experience of getting on stage and delivering this talk. Yeah, leading up, let's see, I'll just kind of tell the story. Leading up to it, I would say the final half hour before it started, I was actually feeling pretty calm. And one of the interesting bits was I was expecting there to be a podium on stage and there wasn't.
Yeah.
So my plan all along was to have pretty minimal slides because I didn't want to fall into the trap of potentially reading my slides and I wanted people to be focused on what I was saying and not what was up on the screen, right? So I had the talk broken up into 4 different parts and basically the 4 steps of this transformation that I was talking about. So I just had a headline for each step and I was planning to riff on each one for 3 to 4 minutes each. And I had an outline condensed down to 1 page that I'd used in my practice. And it was, I felt like I was getting to the point where every time I delivered it in practice, I was like starting to bore myself. Like I felt like I had such a good grasp on my examples and the points I was going to give that the outline was becoming unnecessary. So since there was no podium, nothing to set my outline on, I decided not to take it with me. That was probably a mistake in hindsight. But yeah, I was feeling pretty confident, trying to just remain calm. And so I was first up on the first day, which was nice. Got to get it out of the way early. But yeah, the first time stepping on the stage, it was a different feel than I could have pictured. Like I was warned ahead of time that the lights were bright from the back of the room because the recording was back there. And so, you know, someone had told me like you could basically only see the first few rows, which could be a good thing if you're looking out at a sea of faces and potentially getting distracted by that, then what you're seeing is limited, right, to the first few rows. So I wasn't too afraid of that. But it all came back to me as soon as I got up there, held the mic up to my mouth and started talking. I was like, that's right. You have to contend with hearing yourself coming through the speakers a little bit. And you have to contend with your voice not sounding the way that you expect it to sound and the bright lights and the lack of having your safety net was actually threw me off a bit.
The safety net of the notes?
The safety net of the notes, yeah. Mm-hmm. And even small things like seeing the timer tick down next to the slides. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a really good thing if you're experienced and you want to have the real-time timer clicking down the whole time so you can keep track of where you are. But if you're not, then that almost can be a distraction because you're questioning yourself, wait, am I on track? Am I moving too fast? Am I moving too slow? And those are all just opportunities for distraction to creep in while you're up there.
Yeah.
So I started the talk. It was all a blur, man. Like I don't even really remember what I said up there.
My talk too, by the way. It feels
really?
It races by.
Yeah. It was interesting. I did take a look at the MicroConf recap notes. Uh-huh. There's always a scribe that takes detailed notes on all the talks.
Yep.
I was pleasantly surprised to see like most of my content made it into the notes.
Yep.
But there were, yeah, I got to my second point. I was about 5 minutes in and completely drew a blank on the example I was going to give,
mm-hmm.
which surprised me. And so that was the one stumble I made where in total, I ended up leaving out probably 3 examples that I wanted to give.
Uh-huh.
Just because my mind was a mess up there.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, no one knows that. No one knows my outline. The only tell was that I was obviously nervous and I did stumble once and was like, okay, hang on a second. Lost my train of thought.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try to think of what I was supposed to say. And I gave myself maybe 5 seconds, which felt like an eternity.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't coming to me. So I just punted on that point and moved on.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately ended my talk a little bit early. I didn't use my full 12 minutes because some of those examples were left out.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, coming off the stage, my initial assessment of myself was that I totally bombed.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting being in the audience because I saw you like lose your train of thought. And then I just sort of like saw you in your head, like thinking, oh God, now I'm bombing. And I was thinking, and I was feeling empathy for you in that moment because the thing I was literally thinking was, he's going to think this was way worse than it was and is going to be beating himself up about it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. Right?
I got to go back behind the stage curtain for the next 45 minutes while the other talks were being delivered. Uh-huh. And I was just, that was terrible.
Yeah. What were you thinking?
I was just mad at myself. Like, mm-hmm. how could I bomb this badly on the stage that I feel like is a really important stage? Like, this is my audience, this is my people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a high caliber of people there, especially at the Growth Edition. You know, there's super successful business people running multi-million-dollar companies. And here I'm trying to throw in my 2 cents about some small slice of the work I do. And feeling like you've bombed in that moment is just a terrible feeling.
Yeah.
And luckily, I talked to some friends backstage. I got to talk to Rob back there, and he was kind of like, look, man, it wasn't as bad as you said. He's like, I understand you're mad at yourself right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then really the validation came when the next break came and I came out from behind the stage and I was like, well, guys, I totally bombed, didn't I? And everyone was kind of like, what are you talking about?
Right, exactly. It was funny. There was someone standing there with us as we were chatting with you and you were saying like, oh, like I totally bombed it. And he was like, ha, ha, ha. And then he was like, wait, seriously? And like he thought you were joking.
Yeah, yeah.
Just goes to show like it's so hard to like... Like, we're so hard on... People are so hard on themselves. Everyone is.
Oh, yeah.
It's so hard to be gentle with yourself in the face of, you know, not performing how you want to.
Yeah. I think I have been characterized as a perfectionist before, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that definitely rears its ugly head in scenarios like this, where you're trying to evaluate your own performance.
And I think when you think of this from a more neutral perspective, and you say, how did the first talk you ever gave at MicroConf go? And you say, mm-hmm. oh, I forgot an example or two that I wanted to give and I finished a little early. It was like,
yeah,
okay. And?
Right.
It's like, why are you beating yourself up? Like, that is 100% a normal thing to have happen in a talk, like one of your, like the first talks you're giving.
Yeah.
Or even late. Like, that's normal anytime, actually.
Yeah.
And the notes thing, it turns out, was a big variable. So it wasn't mm-hmm. like so much that like you screwed up your talk. It was like, oh, there was this thing you weren't anticipating and you thought you could rely on your memory, but in practice, when you have those nerves going, like sometimes stuff just like disappears.
Yeah, you're in like fight or flight mode, which
totally.
I think that's basically what it is. You know, you're looking out at this and it's like your lizard brain taking over. Like it's like you lose total control. Like
mm-hmm.
I had it memorized, but that doesn't matter in that moment because your brain is clicked into a different mode.
Yeah. Minimizing the number of variables between practice and performance is like such a huge thing.
Yes.
I wish you had said I'm thinking about not using my notes for example. Because I would say, have you been practicing with your notes? And you'd say, yes. I'd say, okay, bring your notes.
Yeah.
Like, even just hold them. Or like, so I actually asked Xander to put like a stool out on stage during my talk because I had been using some notes still. Mm-hmm. And I wanted a little place just to put those in case I needed to fall back on them.
Yeah. So that's lesson number one.
Yeah.
Is I definitely would have had my notes with me at least folded up in my back pocket in case I needed to pull them out.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. Number two is I would have stepped up on stage at least once before, you know, and just like during a break or something, just stood up there and maybe done a little, like a few words into the mic just to feel what it feels like.
Yeah.
So it wasn't the first time, you know, feeling that room.
Yep.
What else? Oh, I probably would have put a bit more on my slides, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I think I could have stood to do that. And in talking with Rob afterward, he's like, you know, I usually use, it's like I put enough on the slides to prompt me in the event that I do need a reminder of what I was supposed to say next.
Yeah.
But I never feel like he's a slide reader, you know, like that.
Totally.
So I think there's a balance there to be had. And I know I swung pretty far in the direction of minimalist slides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
that may have been my fault.
No, I mean, I like the spirit of it. And I think this talk definitely could have been delivered without more things on the slides. But I think probably my level of experience, I probably needed as many safety nets as possible, just for my own comfort level, you know.
One more thing just on that. So I've competed in singing events before.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have judges and they're scoring how you're doing. And sometimes during performances, like a blip will happen, like kind of what happened with you, where you just sort of like lost your train and couldn't remember the thing and like had to skip to the next slide.
Yep.
And those are categorized as performance errors, which is different than like how they're rating you. So it's like, okay, they messed that thing up. But in my eye, I can tell that that is not how they like what would normally happen to them. It's just that this one time out of 50, they happen to have that error. And so it's like they give you a little penalty. It's like, okay, that was an error, but it's not like we've marked you down in the singing category because we think you can't sing. Like there's a distinction between those two things. And I think that's a great way to think about things like that happen.
Right. It's relatively small in the grand scheme.
I guess. Is. Yeah. And people can look at it with compassion or empathy and say, yeah, that was, you know, you had a little blip there, but like, I can tell it's a blip. It's not like you didn't practice this talk or like, if you gave this again, I'm sure you would not make that same mistake.
Right.
Yeah. Holy moly, guess who sponsored this show? I bet you know it's FreshBooks. That's a little song I wrote called I Bet You Know Who Sponsored This Show by Ben Orenstein. It's off my new album, Ben Orenstein by Ben Orenstein. It's on vinyl. It has 12 songs. Song number one, I Got the Invoicing Blues. Song number two, Cloud Accounting Software for the Masses and Why It's Awesome, Redux. I have a guest vocalist on some of those tracks. Derek Reimer shows up for several raps. He does, honestly, a really amazing rap on track 7, which is Life as a Freelancer, where he talks about his days in the trenches and the struggles he went through at FreshBooks. If you want to send a professional invoice, boom, 30 seconds later, done. Want to get paid online? Sure. You can get paid up to 4 days faster. People can give you a credit card just to pay you when you've done some wonderful work for them. As a side bonus, you get a 30-day unrestricted free trial for FreshBooks. If you want to claim that, just go to freshbooks.com/giantrobots and enter Giant Robots in the How Did You Hear About Us section for a trial of the best invoicing, booking, freshing software out on that internet. Thanks, FreshBooks, for sponsoring this podcast. So you touched on slides for a second, and I have an interesting slide story, which is as of, I think, like Sunday, I was going to use no slides.
Mm.
And so I had submitted like a, here's my intro slide and here's my conclusion slide, and that's it. And I was chatting with Rob about that. And he was like, you know, just think about maybe having some slides. He was like, we've been doing this for a while and we've seen people, and sometimes the people without slides end up kind of tanking because it's hard to hold attention without some sort of visual aid there. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I'm not going to tell you to do it, but think about it. And it was interesting. I was still kind of like on the fence. I was like, I still kind of don't want to do it. But I was thinking, if I don't use slides and I bomb, then I'm a real jerk. You know, like if I use slides and I'm on, then like at least I tried. But if I was like, no, I'm sticking with this, then it's like, wow, like way to ignore some advice like from someone that's been doing this for a while. And right. So I was like, okay, fine, I'm gonna make some slides. And so I did, and I went with like pretty minimal slides like you did, where most of my mm-hmm. slides had just a couple words. Like people reading from slides is one of my pet peeves.
Yeah.
And so I avoided that. But I think I found a way to make them enhance the talk. Like mm-hmm. I included some interesting screenshots and just some like things that kind of accented what I was saying and gave people like mm-hmm. a little something to look at during my points. And I think the talk was actually a lot stronger because of it.
Yeah.
I'm surprised to hear myself saying that at the end of the day, I think the talk, it needed it and it helped a lot.
Yeah, that's good to know. Yeah. I feel like as a viewer, yeah, there's only a few talks I can think of where the speaker was able to hold my attention without any slides. And I think they were predominantly inspirational type of talks.
Yeah.
You know, yep. If there's anything technical going on, then I feel like there needs to be something up there.
Mm-hmm. And Rob made a good point. He was like, you know, Steve Jobs used slides. I was like, okay, that's a good point. Like, yeah. Gary Vaynerchuk uses slides and like he brings all the energy. So it's like, okay, that's fair.
Fair points.
So yeah, I'm glad I did that in retrospect.
Yeah.
I want to bring up a thing. And you said this not knowing it was going to be on the podcast, so we can cut this bit if you don't want it. But sure. There was a point after your talk where we're chatting and kind of trying to like reassure you that like the sky wasn't falling and everything was actually okay and that you were a good and impressive person. Uh-huh. And at one point I was like, dude, like you are the co-founder of Drip. Like, don't forget that. And you said, I feel like that means nothing. Do you remember that?
I do, yeah.
You may have still been in your post-talk shock.
So I was partially in post-talk shock, but I think I've definitely experienced a fair amount of imposter syndrome, mm-hmm. you know, which is pretty common among us developer types.
Or humans.
I don't know. Yeah. So I was feeling in that moment like, sure, I have like this impressive resume item, I guess, so mm-hmm. to speak, you know, but like, well, what does that really mean if I just delivered a terrible talk, you know, like.
It's funny that 12 minute talk subsumed all of your previous accomplishments.
It did.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
That's why I wanted to bring that up is like, it's just so easy to like discount your own successes.
It is. Yeah.
Especially in the light of like a recent failure, like that recency bias creeps in a lot.
Yeah. I like to think that I've gotten pretty sure of myself, but something so far outside of my comfort zone, like speaking on the MicroConf stage, was certainly enough to rattle me for a good hour at least.
Yep.
Took a while to recover, but in that moment when you just feel like you've done something poorly, it's very little consolation that you have accomplishments on your resume, I guess.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. It is.
Yeah. And I wanted to like bring that up and have other people hear that because I think this happens a lot to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was worth getting it out there a little bit because there probably are a lot of people that are impressed by that accomplishment and like look up to you and assume like, well, if I had done that, like I would just always be walking around with a permanent strut or something.
Right.
And it turns out in practice, it's kind of like that, I don't know, like the hedonic treadmill where it's like when you've got the thing, you're like, okay, I got the thing. Like whatever. Now it's no big deal anymore. And you're focused on the next thing or the latest thing.
Right. I mean, it's partially not being an ego-driven person where like it's definitely a success, but it doesn't feel like some crazy unique success because it was 5 years in the making, you know, and there's been so many trials and missteps along the way and just, you know, I don't know, everything that goes into building a business mm-hmm. where at the end of the day, it feels like, well, yeah, we've made it here and that might look impressive on the outside, but I'm seeing it from the inside perspective and the whole journey to where we made it, you know?
Yeah,
and
totally. But it's funny that I'm trying to imagine what you're comparing yourself to. And it sounds like just like outlier, like extreme outliers and things where you don't have that inside perspective.
Yeah.
There's some like awesome quote about like you're seeing like your full life, but you're seeing other people's highlight reels.
Right.
And so it's really dangerous to compare yourself to those other things.
Right.
That's fascinating to me.
Yeah. So when someone like raises a point from your highlight reel, like, oh, you co-founded Drip. It's like, yeah, but I've got the whole story and it's not that impressive.
I remember how hard it was. And, yeah. How close we came to dying that one time. And
right.
All the database queues.
Yeah. Yeah. The ongoing saga.
The database. Yeah. Well, thanks for letting me talk about that.
Yeah. Sure.
Cool. So we had an interesting thing happening on FormKeep this week, which is suddenly, for unknown reasons, there are a bunch of Tor exit nodes that are spamming the crap out of a number of our customers.
Oh.
And it's really unclear to me why. Like, we have like people, so like we have people whose forms have just an email address entry, and suddenly they're getting all these bogus Hotmail and Yahoo and AOL email addresses shoved into them like every 15 minutes all day.
Interesting. Yeah.
Which I don't understand as a spamming tactic. And so I figured you might have some insight into this. I imagine you're dealing with a lot of this probably from the other side, like people that want to use Drip to do this spamming.
Yeah. Actually, we just talked about it a few weeks ago, I think, where our public forum endpoints do occasionally get spammed aggressively.
Uh-huh.
So one of the things we did was implemented optional reCAPTCHA, or is it just called CAPTCHA now? I'm not sure. The I'm not a robot checkbox.
Yeah.
So that helps part of the way. It's an annoyance that people have to put that on, you know, if they want to mitigate a spam problem. But there appears to be no rhyme or reason to it. We've noticed it's not like a guaranteed thing that if you have this public forum on your website that it's going to get spammed. But as soon as it does get swept up, oftentimes your site is just like forever subject to spam requests.
But why? What is the value of shoving these email addresses? I'm pretty sure they're not even valid emails.
Yeah. I think it's just a volume play. Like, it is so cheap for them to scrape these sites, find forum endpoints, and just post to them and try to see if that'll... Yeah, I don't know what their end game is, to be honest. Like,
it would be one thing if like they were submitting like a URL. Like, that would make sense to me. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, okay, there's some junk, and also I want you to click this link and go here or buy this thing or something.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not.
Yeah. I don't know.
Okay.
Now that we dig this deep into it, it doesn't make any sense to me either.
Okay.
Why it happens.
So yeah. You're using reCAPTCHA. We're starting to work on basically throttling Tor exit nodes, because it's basically all coming from there. And so we're using Akismet for spam filtering, and it's capturing about 2/3 of it, but there's still about 1/3 that's getting through for whatever reason. And so we're working on adding some like a feature basically where if you mark a thing as spam and if it came from a Tor exit node, then we like blacklist that Tor exit nodes for your endpoint for a while, basically. I shouldn't be talking about this. I'm sharing the knowledge with the spammers, but anyway, that's the gist.
They're probably not listening to this podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
So Akismet does email address spam detection?
Yes, reasonably well.
Okay. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, it's crazy. I don't know if I told this story already. Stop me if I did, but we had this customer who was receiving a bunch of spam signups from Russian email addresses, .ru or mail.ru email addresses, and they had set up an automation in Drip that basically anytime one of those came in, they automatically deleted the email address out of their account. So they basically set up their own spam filtering.
Yeah.
But we discovered they had like millions of these email addresses in their account.
Wow.
So at first we thought they were trying to skirt around some billing limitation. Like, these people are taking in email addresses, sending email, and then deleting them right away, which we have had happen before.
Yep.
And we have some safeguards in place against it now. But that's what we thought this person was doing until we discovered that their form endpoint was just getting hammered.
Wow. What a weird vector.
It's a bizarre.
I still don't get it.
It's a bizarre. Yeah.
If anybody gets it, like, please tell me on Twitter. I would love to know the
spammers.
Root cause here. Even please, if you're a spammer, let me know.
Like, anonymously, whatever, however you want to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Just fire me 500 million emails with the answer to this question.
Yeah. The fact that a spammer too can't seem to nail a good phishing email boggles my mind too. Like if they were really smart, wouldn't they just copy the exact text from a real PayPal email and not, you know, try to come up with their own copy? I don't know.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know. So that's been fun. That's like a sand in the gears of progress this week, where it's like, this doesn't help anyone. It just prevents jerks from making our lives worse. What a great use of our time.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we've had quite a bit of that sand in the gears in the Drip history.
Yeah. I imagine you're a big target for that stuff.
Yeah.
It's too bad.
Yeah.
Although I suppose it makes your system more resilient.
For sure. Yeah, it does build on itself. So the more you'll put it in a defense this time, and then it'll knock down a certain vector of attack, so to speak.
Yeah.
And then something else will come up and you'll put up another defense. And after a while, you've got a pretty good fortress.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll call it FormKeep.
You already have like the little fortress logo.
Exactly.
So there you go.
It's appropriate.
There you go.
Cool. Yeah. Anything new in your business world?
Really just trying to get back into it from being out of town for a while.
Yeah.
Did some more pairing this week. It's still working well.
Nice.
So, yeah.
I listened back to our episode where we talked about you pairing, which I never do. I don't know why I decided to do that, but I did. And I agree with what I said about pairing, which is that it's great.
Yeah, Yeah, no, I think it's really good. And yeah, just a very similar example to what we talked about last time of finding a lot of value in working out the initial architecture of features and then turning people loose on them, you know? And it's just, yeah, mm-hmm. seems to be much more efficient, which is surprising to me at first that's actually saving time.
Right. I love stuff like that mm-hmm. where it feels like that this should be a compromise or slower and it's actually faster and better.
Yeah, I'm squarely on the pair programming bandwagon.
Okay. Welcome. It's nice. I like it situationally. For me, it's not great for everything, but when things get thorny, it's so nice to pair on it.
Yeah.
Or if someone's new, there's like a lot of, there are a couple, that's I think those are my two favorite things where it's about like knowledge transfer, like getting somebody up to speed mm-hmm. or when mm-hmm. something is kind of hard. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's really nice to just write code by yourself. And pair programming is, I would say its downside is that it's very exhausting. I find it kind of exhausting.
Yeah.
It's like this extended interpersonal interaction plus deep thinking.
Right.
So it does have drawbacks.
Yep.
But cool. Yeah. I'm also kind of digging out that whole like get back in town, inbox full of stuff.
Yeah.
It's just not that fun.
No.
Do you know Dave Thomas?
I know of him.
Okay. So yeah. Same. He had this blog post where he said he always had this experience where he would go on vacation and come back to just so many emails. It would like stress him out while on vacation, just like thinking about his email inbox filling up. And mm-hmm. so one time he went on vacation and set up a script that emailed everyone back that emailed him and said, I've deleted your email. If it's really urgent, throw urgent in the, or like if you just resend it, it'll stay, it'll persist. Hmm. Or if it's urgent, like call this person or something. And tried this for one of his vacations and he said it worked beautifully. Like he relaxed because of it and he came back and there's almost nothing there. Like almost no one like resent him an email,
yep.
but he did get a bunch of follow-ups from people saying like, that's such a good idea. I have to do this. That's amazing.
Wow. Yeah. That is cool.
I like that a lot. That sort of thing appeals to me a lot where it's like, you just turn something on its head mm-hmm. where it's like, oh man, I'm going to have so much email to follow up on. It's like, what if you just deleted all of it? Would it be fine? Mm-hmm. Like, what if we didn't do this thing? What if we didn't write that code? What if we, you know, just, what if we deleted all my email?
Yep.
That stuff appeals to me so much.
Put on your contrarian hat.
Yeah, exactly. Because sometimes I think it works really well.
How much email do you tend to get in a day?
I don't get that much. I'm like a pretty aggressive. I have a lot of filters.
So do I. Yeah.
And I'm a aggressive unsubscriber and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's probably 20 to 30 emails a day, somewhere in there.
Yeah. Mine's about the same, I think. Well, and a lot of like GitHub notifications and...
Yeah. There's still noise. It's like a continuous process of fighting the noise.
Yeah.
I feel like apps will often roll out a new like, and now here's your weekly stats email or your monthly stats email or something. And it's like, mm-hmm. And I have to unsubscribe from this too.
Yep.
But it's not too bad.
Yeah. It's gradually becoming, I think I brought this up maybe 4 or 5 months ago on this podcast where like the feeling of going on vacation and feeling like, you know, things are not moving quite as well when I'm gone or that there's like a stack of pull requests to review. And that is gradually getting better.
Nice.
Which I'm pleased about. And, you know, it's not something that's you have an overnight fix for. It's a matter of getting the right people in place on your team, getting people up to speed, getting the right, you know, delegating review tasks.
Mm-hmm.
And all these things are, I'm starting to see the fruits of the labor of doing that. Because I came back and things got shipped while I was gone. And mm-hmm. there was a small stack of things needing my review, but not everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very nice.
I have a story. I was talking to Brendan Schwartz, who's one of the co-founders of Wistia.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying it had just been like two of them for so long. But eventually they did start hiring people. And he had this experience where he was demoing the product to some people at a conference. And he refreshed like the homepage and it was different. And like he didn't know that was going to be happening and didn't know it was rolling out. And he was just like, oh my God, like it just got better and I didn't do it. And he had a kind of like light bulb moment of like, oh, hiring people. I get it now.
Yep.
That sounds like a nice thing to have happen.
It is very nice. It's hard to give up control. And that's something that I think probably warrants a separate conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Just the process of gradually giving up control when you start out with just two and then
totally
going to more than two. But it's definitely necessary and worth it.
Yeah. Sounds good. Want to wrap it up?
Yeah, let's wrap it.
Awesome. Today's show was produced and edited by, I don't have a pun for Tom's name this week, Obarski. If you'd like to access the show notes for this episode, you can go to giantrobots.fm/237. Thanks for listening.